Well, hello everyone, and welcome to this month's issue of Critical Decisions in Emergency Medicine. This is the February 2019 issue, and with me here is Wendy.
Hi, Tanya.
Hi, Wendy. And as you guys probably know by now, Critical Decisions in Emergency Medicine is ACEP's official CME publication. The way this fantastic publication is organized is that it has two lessons. They are usually coming from the EM model, so they can be anywhere from cutting edge to bread and butter of emergency medicine. And these lessons are organized in a way that discusses the critical decisions that you have to make while you are caring for patients. And then in addition to that, there are many fantastic features in each publication.
Yes, there's the critical EKG, the critical procedure, the critical image, as well as my favorite, the LLSA review.
And for our first lesson of today, it is called Dangerous Creatures. Envenomation.
Scary stuff.
Creepy Crawlers is actually the name of the lesson. So thank you to Dr. Kathleen Cowling and Dr. Thomas Ferrari for writing this.
All right. So, Donnie, I guess first things first, what's the difference between venomous and poisonous creatures?
Things. When something is venomous, not only does it have the glands that produce the venom, but it also has an apparatus by which it delivers it. So, fangs, for example.
Okay.
So, let's think of this. What do you think is the number one venomous creature?
Snakes?
Nope. Guess again.
Spiders?
Close, yes! Oh, bees! Exactly. So it is the entire family of Hymenoptera.
Okay.
So that's your bees, your wasps, and all of that. It is after that followed by snakes and spiders.
I see. All right, so let's start talking about snakes. What poisonous snakes do we have to worry about?
Venomous, Wendy.
That's right, venomous, because they have a gland.
And the apparatus.
That's right.
Exactly.
Okay.
So in the United States, the venomous snakes that we should worry about are rattlesnakes, copperheads, and coral snakes. And the way you differentiate between these is that by knowing what concerning snakes look like. So one thing that you could do is you can, you know, it's 2019. What do? When we see something that's scary and dangerous?
We take a selfie.
Well, maybe not a selfie with it, but just flip your camera and take a photo of it. That probably would be from a safe distance.
Right, because now we have fancy cameras with zooms and all that.
Yeah, so please do not take a selfie with any venomous snakes, even if it looks like it is dead, because if you touch a dead snake, they may actually have an intact bite reflex and it might bite you.
That's right, because there's no way I'm getting close enough to figure out its eye shape or its colorations.
Or count the teeth or something.
Right.
But there's something to remember, and that's also helpful for, of course, the boards. It's red next to yellow, you're a dead fellow. Red next to black, venom they lack. And that only applies to the United States. However, if you have a picture of the snake, or if the person who got bit has a picture of the snake, you can Google it, because Google is your friend.
That's right.
The article does have quite a few pictures in there, so if you're not feeling creeped out already by this conversation, please take a look. They are so pretty, though. They're like red and yellow and black. I think snakes are very pretty.
Venomous.
The pictures can't venomize me.
Okay. All right, so let's say you're an unlucky fella and you got bit by a snake. What are you going to do?
So the comforting thing about this is that 25% of bites are dry, which means that they will not have any venom in them. So you have 1 in 4 chance that you are perfectly fine. There's absolutely nothing wrong with you. Now, if it's a wet bite, which means that there was venom in it, then you're going to have pain and edema in the area. Depending on the type of snake, if it's a pit viper, then the badness of it is usually coagulopathy. If it's a coral snake, then guess what the badness is of it?
Neurotoxicity.
Absolutely.
And some of the concerns we have is flaccid paralysis, right?
Yep. And it's usually descending paralysis. So they would start with bulbar palsy and then it kind of goes down to their closest part, which is their lungs. Yikes. Right? So their respiratory apparatus, basically.
Okay. So you have a bite. You're trying to figure out what are, I guess, our next steps.
So just like all emergency medicine patients, ABCs are the first thing that you want to do, right? And then after that, try to get a history if the patient's stable. So if the patient's stable, try to get a history about like the timing, the number of bites that they think it is. You can call your poison control or your local zoo actually for help. I don't think I've ever tried to call a zoo for anything. But hey, you know, there's always a first time. And then the interesting part, and I actually started looking this up while reading this article, is that you definitely do want to immobilize that part if it's a limb, right? You're trying to immobilize it to decrease its movement so you can decrease the blood flow. But the question I had in my mind is, do you immobilize it and put it at the level of your heart, higher than your heart or lower than your heart? And this article actually says that you should keep it above heart level, and the idea is that you're trying to decrease the pain and the edema.
Oh.
But there are some arguments out there that you don't want to put it at heart level because it increases the transport to your heart. So, you know, something to think about.
Pain, edema versus faster the venom gets to your heart, I mean.
So that's, and that was the interesting thing, is that there's no actual consensus. So, you know, people make it, I don't think there's going to be a randomized controlled trial about this anytime soon. So, but definitely immobilize it. And then you need to clean the wound, irrigate it, and then get some labs.
Okay.
You want to look for evidence of coagulopathy, right? So you want your CBC, your coags. Look for rhabdo, so you would get a CK, a UA. Look for evidence of DIC, so get a dimer and fibrinogen and get an EKG.
What about those, you know, first aid, people do these, you know, Girl Scout, Boy Scout things. Do they do tourniquets or do they suck out the wound?
Do not put any tourniquets or suck out the wound, which is called incision and oral suction. That sounds like a bad idea.
Okay, got it. As you can tell, I was never a Girl Scout.
Well, I don't know. So I actually did find an article from 2002 that advised us to do that. So 15 years ago, probably Girl Scouts, you know, when...
when we were little, yeah.
Okay. I was not going to make any age references there, Wendy. But I think 15 years ago is when you would have been a Girl Scout.
Got it. All right. So is there anything specific in terms of the way we immobilize the limb?
So you do need to apply pressure on it if it is a coral snake bite, but not for the pit. And the way I remember that is that if you're worried about coagulopathy, you probably don't want to smush the limb.
Good point. All right. So you're going to immobilize the limb, maybe with pressure if you're worried about a coral snake bite. You're going to do some local wound assessments, like cleaning it out. Checking your distal pulses, vital signs?
So you definitely want to do that regularly and actually monitor them that way. So keep looking at the wound. You can mark the edema and erythema because the rate of progression is going to help you figure out how bad this is, and continue to do your distal checks and pulse checks. And of course, what you like to do all the time, which is your neuro checks. So especially if this was one of the coral snake bites or if it is one of the pit vipers that has a little bit of neurotoxins in it, then you want to make sure that the respiratory status is unchanged. And of course, these things are very, very, very painful. So analgesia is a big thing.
Got it. Okay. How else can we treat this? There must be an antidote, right?
So yes and no. For the crotalid you have, or the pit vipers, you have Crofab. And this is the only FDA-approved antivenom. Back in the day, they used to say that you should only use that for moderate to severe envenomations or if there's any airway compromise. Now, as long as the effects are progressive, so you're drawing these lines for the edema and erythema, and they're progressing quickly, then you should give them the antivenom.
Okay, got it.
Now, for coral snakes, there is an antivenom that is not an FDA-approved one, and if it's available, you can give it. But you probably, unless you're in an area that has a lot of it, then you may not have access to it. And with coral snakes, like we said, you're worried about the neurotoxin component. So that's definitely a person you want to do close monitoring of the respiratory status. The idea is with a neurotoxin, it's like it's a cholinergic toxidrome in a way. So you want to give them atropine and neostigmine.
I see. All right.
If you need.
Yikes. You mentioned not ever having to call a zoo. I think this is the time you need to call a zoo, right? Because they would have antivenom if that's the appropriate treatment you need.
Yep.
Okay, so how do we dispose these patients?
So if you have somebody who was bit by a pit viper.
That's a...
bit by a pit.
Right, that's hard to say.
So you observe them for 8 to 12 hours, and if the area that you've marked is not that rapidly progressive, they don't need antivenom, so on and so forth, then they can be just observed for these 12 hours and discharged. With the coral snakes, they need to be admitted for like OBS because they need a 24-hour OBS because the neuro complications can actually be delayed.
Wow, all right. Okay, so we learned a lot about snake bite treatments. What do we do about Hemoptera. Wait. Okay. Bees and those families.
Hymenoptera.
Hymenoptera.
So there's actually a YouTube channel that teaches you how to pronounce all sorts of things like that because, you know, I'm foreign. So, you know, I need help.
I do too.
So I think that the big lesson from this lesson is that you can Google and YouTube everything. And
which might be helpful when you're in the woods too, in terms of acute snake bite.
I don't think you have reception in the woods.
Well, you were suggesting to Google the picture of the snake.
When I'm sitting in my emergency department and somebody brought the, yeah.
Okay, all right. Got it.
So with the Hymenoptera, they're actually scarier than snakes. Although we, you know, think of snakes and think of scary. How deadly do you think they are?
Well, you said scarier, so it must be more deadly.
Well, that's true. So it is estimated that 30% of all animal-related deaths are related to Hymenopteras.
That's because of people having, like, an allergy?
Yep.
Oh.
Absolutely. It's anaphylaxis. Mm-hmm. So they are scarier than, like, sharks and tigers and snakes.
And bears. Oh, my.
Yes, it definitely is scarier than all of that. Now, if you don't die from anaphylaxis, then the majority of people are just going to have a local irritation, maybe an allergic reaction, so it's more annoying than scary. But and with anaphylaxis, you just treat it just like anaphylaxis. So you give them epi, fluids, ABCs, of course, preceding everything.
Okay, all right. What about other creepy crawlers? You know, we always have patients who come in and say they got bitten by a black widow.
Well, they usually say that they've got bit by a spider, and I totally dismissed that until one day I actually had a lady come in and said that she was bit by a spider and needed surgery. So, you know, I was waiting to look at her abscess, and she actually had a massive necrotic wound from a brown recluse spider.
Oh.
Yes. So she actually was bit by a spider. That was right. That was real.
That's true.
So those are the two big spiders that we worry about. They're actually not big spiders. They're small spiders. But the black widow and the brown recluse. And the article does talk about the features that differentiate regular spider from a black widow spider and the brown recluse and the number of eyes. And please don't pick up the spider to, you know, figure out which one it is. Just whack it.
Make sure it's smushed if you bring it to the emergency department.
Do not bring it to the emergency department. Just take a picture with it. And the funny thing about the article, it says that there are at-risk activities that can expose you to the black widow. And one of them is cleaning the garage, which I thought was very funny.
Is that why most men don't clean the garage?
Yes, it's a public health risk.
Right. We're going to get in so much trouble from our listeners for this.
Hey, the article said cleaning the garage, okay? You guys can check the article and read that.
All right, so they come in with a legit spider bite. What's the difference?
So the bite looks a little different. It actually looks like a target lesion with central clearing, or it actually looks like a wheal and flare. And the difference between that and a regular spider bite is that, you know, you can die.
So aside from death, what are the other symptoms?
Well, that's usually the most important one. Actually, death is a rare complication relative to the other stuff, but when you're comparing it to zero death, it's a lot. But the symptoms are actually called latrodectism, which means nausea, vomiting, headache, shortness of breath, and the big one is muscle spasm. And it depends on what part of your body gets bit. So if you get bit on your arm, it's going to be your chest that's going to have the spasms, and if it's a leg or lower extremity, then it's going to be the abdomen. And the muscle spasm is so bad that actually there's a lot of, you know, textbook talk about this, that it looks like a rigid surgical abdomen because they're having so much spasm with their belly.
Wow, that sounds like a board review question.
Yes, ta-ta-ta! Because actually the in-service for the residents is in February, so...
Exactly. Are they painful?
The black widow bites are painful, but the brown recluse ones are not. And then 2 to 8 hours later, they just become very, very painful. And then you have this like plaque or papule, and then 10% of them are the ones that have this necrosis. So you have a red or blue central discoloration that turns into an eschar.
So it's a local wound we have to worry about, or is there something more that leads to death?
Well, there is things that lead to death. So there's something called systemic loxolism, which is fever, malaise, nausea, vomiting, myalgia, seizures, altered mental status. And if it gets really, really bad, then they can have renal failure and DIC.
What do we do for that?
So for all spider bites, what you need to do if you're concerned is obviously get labs if you're thinking of a severe envenomation. Things to look for, your DIC and so on, so your CBC, your coags, and all of that fun stuff. Get an EKG and then do local wound care and update their tetanus and treat them symptomatically. If it's a black widow bite and they're having a lot of spasm, then you can actually give the benzos for rigidity. There is an anti-venom out there for the black widow spider bite, but it has so many side effects that it's usually reserved for those that have very, very, very severe symptoms.
I see. So do we observe these patients?
So if the envenomation does not appear to be severe, then you can discharge them after 6 hours.
All right. The most interesting part of this article, scorpions.
So I have never seen scorpion bites here.
Me neither. But they're interesting.
They are very interesting. So as you know, I went to medical school in Saudi Arabia, and depending on which hospital I worked at and depending on where the patients came from, they would actually have scorpion bites. And I actually remember an older man who came in with a scorpion in a Ziploc bag.
Alive? Dead?
It was alive.
Oh, okay.
And the best part was that when he showed me the bag, he didn't tell me it was still alive. It was creepy.
Oh my gosh.
But I mean, it was a Ziploc bag, so at least it was a secure bag.
I would think that it can poke a hole through that bag.
I think that should be our next randomized controlled trial. Of if Ziploc bags are safe for scorpions or not.
Yeah. No.
So, in the United States, there are two kinds of scorpions that we should worry about. One is called the Arizona bark scorpion, and the second one is called the striped black scorpion. And the most important part about these is that you need to understand kind of like the grading of the envenomation. So with grade one, it's just local pain, paresthesia, whatever. So with level two, it is pain or paresthesia at the site and at a secondary remote site. With three, then you have all the things in level two. But these patients start to have cranial nerve dysfunction. And that is the big thing with them. And autonomic irregularities. So they can have like nystagmus, dysphagia, drooling, dysarthria. They can have skeletal neuromuscular involvement like writhing, fasciculations, jerking. And then with an autonomic irregularity like vomiting, bronchospasm, diaphoresis, and tachycardia.
Those are a lot of symptoms, but I did not hear you mention pancreatitis.
So pancreatitis is actually not caused by the Arizona bark scorpion or the striped black scorpion.
Really?
Yep, they are caused by a different kind of scorpion that is not actually common in the United States.
Oh.
It's actually from Trinidad.
Oh.
Yeah. So
see,
it's got
they don't
long...
include that in, you know, your first aid.
It would take them a long time to get from Trinidad to here.
Thank goodness. All right. So I'm assuming we start with the ABCs. Then what?
So the interesting thing about scorpions is that just because of like the way they hide and all that, patients may not actually be aware they were bit by a scorpion. So you definitely need to do a thorough exam. And the article actually mentioned something called the tap test. So if there's an area that looks a little suspicious, you can tap it lightly. And if it really hurts, then it would make you think that if this is scorpion sting.
I see. All right. Do we need any labs or other workup?
The most important thing is actually not the labs or anything. It is doing a good cranial nerve exam.
Yes.
Because that is pretty much one of the bigger things is going to differentiate between the two, the threes, and the fours, which is going to help you figure out what's going to be your next step. Because if you're level three or above, then you definitely need to do a CBC, a CMP, a CK, a UA, basically looking for signs of rhabdo. And then, of course, call poison control.
Okay. I'm assuming this is very painful, so we're going to treat the pain and spasm, too.
So this is actually pretty interesting. Something else that differentiates scorpion stings from the other envenomations that we were just talking about. With all the other ones, you can treat the spasm, you can treat the pain, you can do whatever you want. But with the scorpion stings, if you are going to give an anti-venom, then you should not give narcotics for pain, and you should not give benzos for spasm, because the narcotics are going to worsen the histamine release that's going to happen anyway with the anti-venom, and the benzos are going to worsen the respiratory depression that's going to happen with it. So you're actually going to make them sicker. So if you think that they're going to need anti-venom, and the anti-venom is on the way, then do not use narcotics and benzos, and that is in drastic difference to the other envenomations that we talked about.
All right. Well, that's a lot of information for learning about envenomations. I learned that these creepy crawlers
have glands and they have a mechanism to inject the poison, the venom, into you. So they're not just poisonous. That's why they're venomous.
You guys cannot see Wendy's face, but she's completely creeped out by this. She's way more creeped out than I am.
I don't like snakes. I don't like creepy crawlers.
Snakes are actually pretty cool. Have you touched a snake?
No. Why would you want to do that?
Because they are awesome. Not the venomous ones, though.
I imagine them to feel very weird.
They do. They feel very weird, and they're cold, actually.
I made another face at that. Okay.
We should go to a zoo, you and I.
Well, I'll watch you touch the snake. So, if you come across a snake and you're not sure if it's venomous, you need to take a picture. Please don't bring it to the emergency department. And then you can consult with somebody. I had a friend who was doing some work in Africa and came across a patient who was bitten by a snake and wanted to figure out if the snake was venomous. So he called one of our, attendings who does tox and all that stuff. The first phone call was, "Can you help me identify the snake?" And then the attending was like, "What kind of snake?" "It's an African snake." "But what kind of snake?" "It's an African snake. That's why I'm calling you." So I expect that if I ever come across a snake, it's going to be like, it's a snake. Because I don't know how else to differentiate it. But don't have to worry about snakes as much because bees are much more dangerous.
That's absolutely true.
And for us in Maryland, we don't have to worry about scorpions as much. But if you do come across a scorpion bite, you actually have to be careful in treating pain and muscle rigidity if you're planning on giving them anti-venom, because that can actually worsen the clinical situation.
Those are great take-home points, Wendy. And I'm sure to all of our listeners, if this is not something that you see on a regular basis, it can be very overwhelming because we don't do this often. So remember, you can always call poison control and you can always call your local zoo when it comes to snakes.
I like that. All right.
So now for Wendy's favorite part of the entire publication.
The LLSA review.
And our topic today is unexpected delivery.
Well, the topic isn't quite my favorite because I don't see kids anymore. And newborns, I'm even more iffy about.
Well, with unexpected delivery, you're not actually seeing a child.
Oh, that's true. I'm seeing the adult who is having a baby right in front of you.
Yep.
The good thing is that 90% of deliveries all turn out to be fine. You don't need to do much for it. But it's the 10% we need to worry about. So this article goes through the ABCs with us. A few updates to what we may have learned before. In terms of airway management of these newborns, you can just use positive pressure ventilation, not necessarily with intubation. If you're dealing with somebody with respiratory problems from maybe meconium stained delivery.
So what we're basically focusing on right now is the neonatal resuscitation algorithm, which is their 2015 update. So it used to be that if you see any meconium anywhere near the child or the neonate, then they need to be intubated. But now that is not the case.
Correct.
Got it. What else?
Well, we still would need to supplement ventilation if the neonate has a heart rate less than 100 or has inadequate respiratory effort.
Okay, so less than 100 is your marker that they need some positive pressure ventilation.
Yep. But if their heart rate's less than 60, despite first treating the breathing problem, then they would need CPR, chest compressions.
All right, well, this is something that always makes me pause when I think of neonates, right?
Yeah.
With adults, if they have a heartbeat of any sort, please don't do CPR. Those are very good reminders. Actually, now that you're talking, I'm looking at the article. It does have a very beautiful flowchart. And if you work anywhere in proximity to a hospital, please make sure you have a copy of this on your warmer or somewhere. Because if you're someone like Wendy and I, where you don't see neonates on a regular basis, this is mind-blowing to you. And also, kind of keeping along with our theme of with the envenomation, it's the stuff that's really scary that we don't see often. Welcome to emergency medicine.
Exactly. So the critical EKG this month is also interesting. It's looking at a post-resuscitation EKG with diffuse ischemia.
So this EKG does show an irregular rhythm, which was AFib, and it kind of looked like it was ischemic all over, but it was a really good reminder that we need to think of posterior MIs in certain EKGs. So if you have a tall R wave in the right precordial leads, and you have a large upright T wave, then you have to definitely look for ST segment depression in leads V1 and V2. Because that would be your biggest tip-off that someone has a posterior MI. And that management of that is going to be very different than just, like, lobal ischemia. Because if they're having an infarct, then they need to go to the cath lab. And this is a reminder that we should be getting posterior EKGs on patients.
That's right.
The critical image is also another good reminder of something that we see relatively frequently. And it's a case of someone who's presenting with a typical picture of a kidney stone.
That's right. Except most of the time, well, I say 99.9% of the time, if we get a CT on a patient, they're lying supine on the CT bed.
I think it's a little more than 99.9%.
Correct. Except in this particular image that you can look at in this issue. So if you have stones at the UV junction on a CT in the supine position, you don't know specifically if it is just stones laying dependent in the bladder or it's sitting actually and obstructing at the UV junction.
So basically what you're saying is that the solution is to have the patient lay prone with their face down on the CT table. And that way the stone would either stay stuck at the UV junction where you know it's obstructing or fall into the bladder and then it would be obvious in the CT.
That's right. The critical procedure this month is the superficial cervical plexus regional anesthesia.
I don't think I have ever sat there and thought, I would like to inject a needle in someone's neck so I can numb it up. But you know what? You can inject a needle into somebody's neck to numb it up. The idea is that you will not just numb that skin over your lateral neck, but also the auricle of the ear would be kind of your big one as well. Especially if you have a really nasty ear laceration and you don't have access to someone who would repair that, like a face surgeon or an ear, nose, and throat surgeon or whatever. And then if you're having any issues with the clavicle as well or the AC joint. The article does have a very clear diagram of how you want to identify your anatomical landmarks. And in keeping up with prior articles, it does a good job of explaining the superficial surface landmarks and how you would want to approach it with ultrasound guidance as well. So it does help kind of connect these dots together. A picture is worth a thousand words. It would be very difficult to explain how this would be, but the whole idea is that you would want to inject the needle right underneath your sternocleidomastoid in the superficial layer, and that is where you'd be able to get that numbing of your superficial cervical plexus.
Very nice. Check it out.
And now for our next lesson of this issue is hostile workplace, managing the agitated patient in the emergency department. Thank you to Dr. Lynn Ropolo, Dr. Lilani Klinger, and Dr. Jadidia Leaf for writing this article. The ED is at high risk for violence. It's pretty alarming that actually a survey showed that 78% of emergency providers have experienced at least one violent workplace act in the past 12 months alone, and 20% describe being physically assaulted by a patient. That's horrifying.
It's true. And I think, at least I'm hearing more and more in terms of colleagues and stuff voicing this concern, and certainly ASAP and a lot of other national organizations are trying to take more action against this. The trouble is that the same survey only showed that 16% of these survey programs actually offer training in workplace violence. So I think there's a lot that we can do on programmatic level too, in terms of helping us emergency physicians learn how to handle this.
You're absolutely right, because the patients are going to present with agitation for a multitude of reasons. I know we think of just agitation due to drug intoxication, but there's quite a few other reasons for that. Anything else that we got to keep in mind?
Yeah, so a lot of times I think classically we think about traumatically injured patients, whether or not they're in shock and that's why they're agitated, or maybe they have a traumatic brain injury, or hypoglycemia or hypoxia. Infections, mental illnesses. So there's a lot of things that we have to roll out or keep in mind when we see one of these patients. And our red flags will be abnormal vital signs or a presentation that's not consistent with prior presentations of mental illnesses, etc.
So this article also mentions some scoring scales that we can use to assess a patient's agitation and risk of violent behavior. Do you use these risk stratification scores, Wendy?
I don't. But I thought that the one scale they mentioned, the behavioral activity rating scale, looked a lot like a lot of the other agitation sedation scales, in that, of course, it has scores that are towards the end where people are sedated versus towards the end where people are agitated.
I think, again, just an objective way. I liked how it also correlated not just the level of hyperactivity with the need for restraints or something that you can just redirect somebody from. So that's a nice correlation specific to how we can address this. But I did think that the second scale that the article mentioned that people can look at more is interesting, because the Broset Violence Checklist looks at 6 variables and gives a point for each of these, and it actually stratifies whether or not people are at high risk for a violent behavior. So if people had confusion, irritability, boisterousness, physical threats, verbal threats, or attacks on objects, and you have at least 3 of those, then this patient has a high risk of violence within the next 24 hours. So maybe it helps us to preemptively plan and be proactive in the ED.
You're absolutely right. I think that especially in an environment that cares for a lot of patients that have the underlying issues that you talked about before, whether we're talking about substance use, psychosis, psychiatric illnesses, and so on, if you have a high propensity to having violent patients in your emergency department, it may be worth instituting a checklist to try to figure out how to best use your resources. Because not every person can be in a single room that has nobody else in it, that's been stripped down of everything, that has security at the bedside. But with some patients, that's what you definitely and absolutely need to do to keep yourself and everyone safe.
And we all know that we have to, in some cases, restrain these patients for their and our safety. But we also know that just simply the act of trying to restrain them is dangerous to everybody involved. So ideally, we like to try and de-escalate them in a non-coercive way verbally. And we all know, and Dania, you especially as an educator know, that 90% of emotional information and more than 50% of spoken communication is really actually communicated by body language and verbal tones. And so I think this article really reminded me and how I need to remember to address these patients sometimes, because as they escalate, sometimes we get escalated in our responses too.
And that goes back to the point that you were making earlier, Wendy, is that places need to train their staff on how to address workplace violence from the standpoint of not just, hey, what's a dose of, you know, ketamine that you need to give, but also how can you verbally de-escalate and not get yourself into the situation that you would need ketamine.
Right, exactly.
And we have actually discussed that, not necessarily from the agitated patient, but we have discussed about managing conflicts on a prior podcast. Mm-hmm. So that is definitely somewhere to start, right? Because if the issue that started this is a conflict, then that is one way to actually avoid it as well.
Absolutely. The article did mention that they essentially looked at a recent consensus statement by the American Association for Emergency Psychiatry. And that particular consensus statement has a section on verbal de-escalation that can be a great resource for any of us.
All right, so if you have an agitated patient and you think that it is a psychiatric underlying cause, do they need psych labs?
Not necessarily. Obviously, that might vary by institution. But if a patient is presenting with symptoms that are consistent with prior psychiatric disease, then you may not necessarily need a medical evaluation. But again, keeping in mind of all the other conditions that can present in similar ways.
And when you say medical evaluation, you mean like lab work?
Yes, exactly. Of course, we have to do a medical screening exam, but hopefully not all of them need a lab work.
Okay. Let's say we tried to verbally de-escalate the patient and that was not successful. What do you do?
Well, then you may have to use medications. And our goal really is to try and calm the patient down, not necessarily to sedate them to the point that they're not moving or with that as the primary intent. And so we have lots in our toolbox. I think the idea of this article, and it goes through a lot of different pharmacological options, is that you have to think about maybe the underlying cause and what medication to choose for. We often think about using benzodiazepines, but that's probably good for only agitation when you don't quite know what the etiology is. Whereas, of course, if you have people who have a psychiatric illness or other reasons, you might ideally choose an antipsychotic. I did find that it was interesting that there's no evidence in combining haloperidol with benzodiazepines or antihistamines, which sometimes we do use in combination. And it was a good reminder that all antipsychotics can lower the seizure threshold to various degrees. And of course, ketamine. Ketamine has a lot of applications in the emergency medicine world, and especially probably for excited delirium.
Absolutely. One of my biggest pet peeves is when people want to add antihistamines to other things to sedate people. Okay, Wendy's now moved on to the sad face of please don't ever do that. So that is one of my biggest pet peeves because people just want to add Benadryl to your haloperidol in your patient who's on methadone.
Right.
It's just a recipe for disaster.
I don't think there's ever a role for antihistamines as a way of treating.
Unless they're having anaphylaxis from the medication you give them, please don't give them antihistamines.
Correct. You're just making it muddier.
Yep. So let's say you use the drugs and the drugs did not work. What do you do?
Obviously, this is where physical restraints come in. And so you have to make sure you have enough staff to, you know, help you with it. Because in a lot of these situations, you need somebody for each limb.
And one for the head.
Yes. And a mask over the patient's face so that in case they're spitting or potentially you need to provide supplemental oxygen. So your safety is important. Obviously, that comes with a whole lot of documentation. So when you do restrain somebody physically, you have to make sure they have continuous visual monitoring. So typically a one-to-one sitter of some sort to make sure the patient is safe, that they don't get somehow twisted up in their restraints. They need to be on cardiac, pulse ox, maybe even end-tidal CO2 monitoring. And then, of course, your documentation of your face-to-face assessment that they still need or don't need anymore their physical restraints.
This was a lot of things that we see, unfortunately, on a more regular basis than any of us would like, which is a good summary of how to address your agitated patient. Here's what I heard you, Wendy, say, is that we should keep in mind that there are scores that can be used to kind of predict patients that are more likely to be violent to help you kind of divvy up your resources. If that's an issue, we talked about verbal de-escalation and talking about body language and tone of voice. And you mentioned a really good resource, which is the American Association for Emergency Psychiatry consensus statement. We talked about medical or chemical restraints, and we talked about how to not give antihistamines with it. And then we talked about how physical restraints can be a last resort because they cause a lot of complications such as documentation and rhabdo.
Exactly.
But definitely something that if we need to do that to keep our patients safe and ourselves safe, then you know what? We just got to do it.
That's right. All right. And so moving on to our last little pearls. Our drug box this month, I cannot pronounce. I don't know if you have a better luck than I.
YouTube does not know how to pronounce this yet.
Baloxavir, maybe?
Sure.
Marboxil?
It sounds very real, so yes, sure.
Just so for our listeners, maybe refer to the actual spelling of this since I'm not sure if I'm saying it correctly because this was completely new to me. I did not know that there is an oral medication for influenza A and B that is just a one-time dose.
And this one is also for strains apparently that are resistant to standard antiviral agents.
Wow.
As long as you don't administer it with dairy products, calcium-fortified beverages, antacids. So, no cheese for you.
That's very sad.
If you're dying from influenza, I don't think that would be a problem.
Okay, that's true.
So, this medication does have a side effect of diarrhea, which is really not that common. But other than that, it's something that you got to think about if you have a patient who has flu. They're obviously ill and they're resistant to other antiviral agents. The tox box is chlorine gas poisoning. And we all know chlorine, and we have been in contact with chlorine at some point in time if we've ever been near a pool, right?
That's right.
And I think that the easiest way to remember what chlorine gas poisoning is to remember when you snort a little bit of that pool water and you feel very irritated and annoyed, and that would kind of be your low concentration chlorine gas poisoning, right? Your cough, your dizziness, your shortness of breath, your sore throat, your eye irritation. Obviously, that's not the scary part. It's when it's a high concentration or prolonged exposure, and obviously we're talking about chlorine gas, just straight up gas. And with those patients, you'd have the, like pneumonitis and pulmonary edema. And what was actually pretty interesting in this tox box was that if someone has pneumonitis from chlorine gas poisoning, then you can give them a neb of sodium bicarb.
That's awesome.
Yep. So you can just put a vial of sodium bicarb or an amp in 3 mLs and just nebulize that.
Fantastic. Hopefully we never have to take care of a patient with this, but that's a great pearl.
Thank you, Wendy, for going through this issue with me.
I hope that you guys had as much fun listening to us as we had recording this. As always, we would love to hear from you. Please connect with us on our Twitter accounts. My handle is at Dania Koja.
Mine is at EM_NCC.
And until next month, take care.
Bye-bye.